which I mean, I'm just talking about where Iran is concerned at the moment. So we're talking Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and of course, we're talking about China. Now, there's a lot we can talk, we can say about China, but as far as India is concerned, India is one of the most important countries in the world right now after China. And of course, it isn't just fine with remaining a super or a very strong regional power close to superpower status in South Asia. Increase its clout in Central Asia. One of the impediments towards that relationship, towards it retaining that status, is Pakistan, on the one hand, and the problems it shares with India. So, if India has to wants to become a more influential country, it needs to cooperate with the region's countries. Now, of course, it also has problems with China. And so it needs to further its clout on the economic level with countries in Asia. And Iran happens to be very well located at the geographic level. So naturally, India will have to pick up or increase its relations with Iran.
Now, Mr. Sharara, how does the West view this visit by the Iranian foreign minister to India and its implications and its tensions over their stance on Ukraine?
Okay, as far as the West goes, of course, they're not in favor of India picking up with relations with Iran. Of course, it's not within their interests. They want an isolated Iran, and they don't want India having anything to do with it. However, look, if you go back to recent history, relations between India with Iran have been very formal. There hasn't been a lot of follow through, even though both countries have signed many agreements with one another. So if you look at this recent history, you realize that that this follow through is a lot of it is because of U.S. pressure because many Indian companies are afraid of the possibility of sanctions. So, okay, they're up to signing agreements with Iran so that they can secure a possible future. But the fear of sanctions has them keeping a step behind, so to speak. So the West naturally doesn't look favorably upon any improvement in relations between Iran and India.
Now, Mr. Sharara, you've mentioned the sanctions. Now, will sanctions affect the extent of trade and economic development, or does this willingness to expand ties signal another blow to U.S. and EU attempts at controlling the global market?
Okay, as far as sanctions go, as I just said, there's a lot of fear of sanctions from India, and this has kept both countries from taking their ties up to a new level. When you have so many agreements that haven't been implemented, with Indian companies afraid of investing in the Iranian market for fear of U.S. sanctions, this shows you how the impact of the sanctions has been an impediment. It's been impeding the progress of relations between the two countries. However. The readiness of the fact that Amir Abdullahian has visited India, this in and of itself signifies that India is prepared to overcome some of its problems with the EU and the or some of the implications that this may cause with the EU and the US, because as I said, the US and the EU are currently preoccupied with Ukraine. And also, India has to reinforce its Asian depth, its Asian identity. I mean, of course, India is a huge market for the West, and the West needs it more than India needs the West, first of all. Second of all, after the problems that have happened with Ukraine and the fact that India was prepared to stand up to the West in order to secure or keep its relations secure with Russia and to a larger extent with its neighbors in Central Asia, this shows that we're now seeing, hopefully, what can be the beginning of a restructuring in Indian foreign policy, hopefully, unless the West is able to exert additional pressure in order to keep India from doing this.
Thank you, Mr. Sharara, for being on the program. Now, let's see what people had to say on social media.
Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi hails the centuries-old civilizational links between India and Iran and notes that relations between the two countries have promoted regional security and prosperity. Dr. S. Jaishankar, India's foreign minister, following his meeting with Iranian counterpart Hossein Amir Abdullahian, says both sides reviewed bilateral cooperation, including in trade, connectivity, health and people-to-people ties. Financial securities analyst Sanjeev Basin points to growing cooperation between Iran and India by citing the report about first transfer of Russian goods to India through a new trade corridor that transits Iran.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Offensive remarks made by two BJP officials about the Prophet of Islam and the inevitable wrath of Muslims seems to threaten India's political and economic ties with Muslim countries. A real risk that could prove detrimental to its economic ties with key trade partners and the main energy supplies for the nation. Shortly after their insults, BJP national spokesperson Nupur Sharma and Naveen Kumar Jindal, who is the chief of the party's media cell, apologized for their comments. Nupur Sharma was suspended and Naveen Kumar was expelled from the party. But the wrath of the Muslim community, which has been facing discrimination and hate campaigns for years, led to violent protests across the country.
Offensive remarks by Nupur Sharma, BJP's national spokesperson, during a televised debate and Naveen Jindal's controversial social media post on religious values were followed by worldwide condemnation by Muslims. India witnessed unprecedented public outcry. From East to West Asia, the Persian Gulf and Northern Africa, India's ambassadors were summoned and official statements were issued by various countries condemning the acts of sacrilege and requesting decisive action by the Indian government. The Organization for Islamic Cooperation said in a statement, "These cases of defamation are part of a growing spate of hatred and defamation of Islam in India and systematic practices against Indian Muslims, particularly in light of a set of decisions to prohibit the use of hijab in educational institutions in some Indian states, including demolition of Muslims' properties and growing violence against them." Later, the Indian Foreign Ministry released a statement rejecting the offensive comments and tweets, stressing that these are the views of individuals and do not represent the values of the Indian government. But all the efforts made by BJP officials failed to suppress the public outcry of Muslims and stop nationwide protests. Thousands of Muslims in India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other Muslim countries took to the streets to protest. The protests led to violence in India, leaving few dead and dozens injured, adding to India's long history of anti-Islam sentiments. Thousands of commentators had predicted that the pressure would lead to Muslims' reprisals, which can lead to a new series of ethnic and religious tensions.
The founders of a free India, including Jawaharlal Nehru, made the right decision to create a secular state, and one of the reasons for the decision was to accommodate the plethora of ethnic and religious identities in the nation. But since the BJP came into power, discriminatory and extremist policies implemented against Muslims have created a tense atmosphere in the country. Despite the emphasis of the Indian constitution on its secular nature, pressures against the Muslim minority seem to be intensifying as of late. They started with the implementation of extremist regulations against religious minorities, but have led to beating and even killing of Muslims and the demolition of the houses by extremists.
Muslims form 13% of India's total population. This 200 million strong population that has peacefully coexisted with other religious communities has become alienated from the rest of the nation following British colonialist rule and their policy of divide and conquer. This divide was exacerbated by the rise of the BJP and the parties provoking anti-Muslim sentiments in the public, leading to animosity from the minority Muslim population. Judging by the Babri Mosque case and the annexation of Kashmir's administrative authority, the Indian nationality law increased pressure against women wearing hijab, and thousands of small instances of harassment of Muslims, a re-evaluation of the performance of Indian officials when it comes to harassment of minorities, seems inevitable. In the recent case of insults against sacred values of Muslims on India's media and social media platforms, the issue has been stretched beyond religious disputes among the nation, becoming a global issue. Analysts believe that the party's reaction to the issue will not be sufficient, and if senior members of the Indian government and its ruling party fail to present an appropriate public response, their ties with other Muslim countries may become undone. 57 members of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation have demanded decisive action by the Indian government to discipline those who insulted the Prophet. If a $90 billion trade agreement with the Gulf Cooperation Council in 2020 to 2021 is at risk, not to mention the work and livelihood of millions of Indians living in its member states, India will be facing a serious challenge on its path to becoming a global powerhouse, because it will need the energy supply and the export market.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Clifton de Rosario, General Secretary at All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Mr. Rosario, welcome to the program. Now, the protests in response to the derogatory comments against Prophet Muhammad have taken India by storm, but is this backlash unexpected after the continuous harassment of Muslims across the country?
Okay. What we're witnessing right now, what we're witnessing right now in our country is really posing some very crucial questions of our nation in terms of how we go forward from here, what the idea of this country is going to be. And I think, one really shouldn't be too surprised. The Islamophobic statements that were made, the kind of bigotry that we are seeing, the targeting of the Muslims, in a sense, which basically is premised on the understanding that Muslims and other minorities, as has always been the case with Dalits, are second-class citizens in this country. That message that is being sought to be drilled into the daily lives of Muslims by state and non-state actors. This, I think, is an extremely challenging time, as it were. And obviously, the Muslim community is not taking this lying down, and they are responding to it. The kind of protest that we saw when the government tried to force down the Citizenship Amendment Act down the throats of people over here.
Mr. Rosario, we know that the Muslim community in India has been discriminated against since the BJP came into power. But after the suspension of anti-Islam political figures, do you think the political pressure is finally working?
The fact that, the BJP national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, and the party's, BJP's Delhi media head, Naveen Kumar Jindal, could so brazenly such vicious Islamophobic statements is something that, I think we have to really take note of. It reflects the kind of bigotry that is running amok in our country. In that sense, it was obvious that, there was going to be some kind of a public outrage against it, as also some kind of international pressure as well. And no doubt, we saw that, several states, whether it's Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Malaysia, etc., who all came out in strong condemnation of it. And of course, the threat at that point was the boycott of Indian goods. That seemed to have, you know, played a big role in the government that's taking the, you know, coming out with the statement that these are fringe elements. And then, of course, you know, just throwing expelling them from the party. One really needs to read between the lines over here. How can they be called fringe? In fact, right now, the slogan that is going across the country is that gali gali mein shor hai, fringe nahi ye core hai. That means everybody knows for sure that these so-called fringe are actually the core. So what both of them have said is something that is being said every day in the media. It is being said in the hate speeches, in the Dharam Sansads. It's being said all across the country.
Mr. Razavia, Muslim countries have condemned the many cases of Islamophobia-fueled comments by BJP officials and demanded an appropriate response by the government. So how can the BJP government mend the damage caused by its anti-Islam policies?
I'm just saying that I'm a little surprised at how people are trying to see this. The point is that if you were to look at the situation of the Muslim community in India, and I'd say from an economic sense, and you have the Rajinder Sachar report, which was brought in when the previous UPA was in power, which basically talks about the extremely vulnerable economic situation of the Muslim community. Now, added to that, you have this virulent attack on the being of the Muslim itself. So whether it's the hijab, whether it's a Muslim street vendor, whether it is COVID, every single context is being communalized. Every single situation is being used for communal polarization. So indeed, you know, this is an extremely, extremely serious situation. But the point is that the pressure that we are talking about comes only at a particular point. Now, from 2014, we have witnessed the lynchings of Muslims. But unfortunately, that did not create that kind of a huge outcry. So the targeting of the Muslims has been happening, you can say, from 2014. It is completely heightened. There's no two ways about it. But there hasn't been any that kind of a corresponding international pressure on the Indian state for it to, you know, push back from its agenda. Its core agenda is this. Alongside this crony capitalist agenda it's one of its core agenda is anti-minority.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Clifton de Rosario for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's go to social media to see what people had to say.
Ashok Swain, an academic and analyst, says massive protests have broken out in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan over derogatory remarks about Prophet Muhammad by India's Hindu right-wing regime officials. Pakistan's former human rights minister, Shireen Mazari, asks why is the OIC not calling a special session to deal with the BJP spokesperson's blasphemous remarks and targeting of protesting Muslims. Khalid Beydoun, a law professor and author, calls on the Arab governments to use their power and influence to prevent state terror being unleashed against Indian Muslims.
And that was our episode on the prospects and challenges of economic cooperation between Iran and India and the domestic, regional and global consequences of insulting the Holy Prophet of Islam. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio, and this is the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their offspring. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have with us in studio today our guest speaker, Brother Al-Musawi. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How are you?
I am doing well, if you are doing well.
Alhamdulillah, I'm doing well as well.
That's
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
So, Brother Musawi, when we talk of Islamic upbringing, there are stages. And the stage of like 1 to 7 year old stage is a kind of stage wherein you have to treat your children as princes or princesses. You have to give them a, like whatever they want. But for some parents, this trend keeps on continuing beyond the age of 7. And sometimes it then becomes terrible for them, I must say. What are your initial thoughts on that?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think one of the most misunderstood ahadiths when it comes to parenting is this one. اتركوهم سبعاً ادبوهم سبعاً صاحبوهم سبعاً. Leave them for 7, befriend them for 7, let them go for 7. It's a very misunderstood hadith. One that says for the first 7 years, treat them like princes or kings, like you said. It didn't mean that you give them an absolute free control.
Yeah.
It means you leave them in the sense that you only monitor. When they you see that they're heading to the wrong path, you kind of give them a push backwards. Not that you say, you know what, do whatever you want. Why? Because you're 3, 4, 7. That's nonsense. You know what I mean? And especially, I mean, if you look at psychology today, they say the most important years of a child's life is the first 7. How could you let him free for the first 7? That's a disaster. That's a disaster recipe for a child to come to this world. What the Imams alayhi wasalam meant by 7 is that in this first 7 years, don't try to be like, don't try to treat them as adults. Give them that freedom to be a child, to do what children want to do. Have you seen a lot of parents when their kids cry? I mean, I always see this. When their kids cry or their kids act, you know, fussy and stuff, the parents get upset and they start yelling at them. They want them to behave. I'm like, no, he's a child. Don't
act mature.
Yeah, let him be a child, you know.
Yeah.
If he doesn't want to have food and he starts with, you know, arguing with his mom, I don't want to eat this, I don't want to do that. Oh, fine, let him be. Don't try to make an adult out of him. This is what they mean. But not to give them an absolute freedom.
Free control.
Especially in our day today. I mean, now, if I remember back in the day, I was 10 years old and I could not navigate a VCR remote. You know what I mean? Like a VCR remote has some. I'm like, wow, what is this, a spaceship? Now, a 2-year-old, he could navigate through an iOS program.
All
you know what I mean? They know how they put your passcode. They navigate to their apps. They go to YouTube. They choose. I've seen this with a two or three year old. They went through the application. They went to the saved list and they got their clips. And I was amazed. And only 3 year old. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now I can't just let them be free. By 7, it's already done. He's gone. I can't do much with him. So when we say, you know, leave them for 7 or he's a prince for 7, it means that you have to monitor, make sure he's safe. I mean, as a mother, as a father, when I see my child trying to, for example, touch fire, should I let him touch the fire or am I going to prevent him? I'm going
to
prevent
him.
Of course, my child, if he could speak, he says, but the imam says, leave me for 7. So I need to touch it. It just doesn't work, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So we basically
need to understand this hadith properly. Leave them free for 7 has some of the meaning that, which you rightly mentioned. I would want you to say more on that note, but after a shorter break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Kindly
contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. I have with me Brother Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. So, brother, you were talking about free control giving to children.
Yeah. So we were saying that freedom is not something that we should indulge our children in. I mean, as Muslims, me and you, are we free?
Not always.
Not always. I mean, we have like a very small room to move in, and there are prohibition. There are things that are forbidden for us. There are things we cannot do. We're not free totally. We have, yes, we have free one. We're free when it comes to choosing and making our own actions. But Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has a lot of things that He wants us to do. So we can't say, I'm absolutely free to do whatever I want. No, you're not. You have freedom in certain things, and certain things you don't. Do I have the freedom to go kill people? No, I don't. Do I have the freedom to go steal from people? No, I don't. Do I have the freedom to drive as fast as I can? No, I don't. So there are a lot of limitations. Same thing with kids. When it comes to kids,
understand the concept of freedom.
Yeah, so we can't give them total freedom because total freedom would definitely kill them. I mean, at least, you know, not literally, but, you know, spiritually or morally or ethically, it will destroy them.
Yeah.
So we need to have that kind of limitation when it comes to what they can do with their freedom. And especially today when we talk about freedoms in schools in the Western countries, at least from where I'm from, they're giving children at grade 3. Mm-hmm. Right? Which is about, I don't know, around 10 years old, 10, 12. At grade 3, they're giving the children the choice to choose their sexuality. Do you want to be homosexual? Do you want to be this or do you want to be that?
I mean, that's terrible.
It's beyond, beyond terrible. Why? But they're doing this under the pretext of freedom. Right?
Oh, my God.
So you need to have, your child needs to be free to choose. Now, they added a new thing recently, which is you can choose if you want to be a he or a she, right? You can choose your gender now, which is a disaster now. I can't have this kind of freedom with my kids. Or when it comes to matters of faith, you can choose what you want to pray, what you want to worship. That doesn't work. So as a parent, I can't give my children an absolute free way of living or a free way of thinking. I can help them. We do encourage parents to give their children the space to think and become a creative. But based on the fact that we draw the guidelines for them first, right? Because now, even if you look in the social media, you'll see that denying the existence of God is a biscuit and a tea. Right,
yeah.
It's as easy as that. And we have the movement of the atheists now. They're moving very hard and they're pushing the agenda very quickly. And, you know, a lot of people falling for it, a lot of kids falling for it, especially our youth. When they come in an environment where the parents, all they do is pray, don't. So much limitations. And then someone else comes with a nice logical argument that says, this is nonsense. You don't have to pray. A lot of guys, a lot of females, they come to me, they say, the Quran never said wear a hijab. Why do I have to wear a hijab? God doesn't care about what you do. God cares about your heart, your akhlaq. He doesn't want you to pray.
Yeah.
You know, as long as your akhlaq is good, you're not harming anyone.
Yeah.
You know, these things are not important.
Exactly.
And so why are they starting to question these core beliefs? First, because they did not have the proper education from the parents. Their faith is very weak. And more importantly, there are people working very hard. I mean, I don't know if you've seen this on TED Talk, where this lady, a Muslim lady, comes on for around a half an hour trying to prove that the Quran did not talk about hijab.
All right. We have, TED also, TED always comes up with the speakers who are controversial. We have seen that. With the TED speakers. Brother, I'll be talking about that with you after a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Ya muqiyal khayrat, ya muqiyal khayrat.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th Surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, "Save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I'm with Brother Al-Musawi, who's talking about the changing trends and the disasters, as Brother, you rightly mentioned, that in the Western societies where you're free to choose your gender as a kid and where you're like free to do so many things, it sounds to me like, you know, you're leaving a kid in the dark jungle and trying to tell him, go and explore without any safe things. And the point you mentioned before the break was very important, that we have some motivational so-called speakers today who come and try to deny the concept of hijab and so many other things, so many Islamic things. And our kids then come and tell us that Allah cares about the iman and faith. He does not care about your appearance and all. So how can we help our children when we live in a society like that?
I myself have lived all my life in a Western society. And I was raised up in the Western society. And I speak for myself as a child. I was drawn into that kind of living. And up to my teen years, that's when I woke up. It is extremely hard living in these environments. And the West themselves, they sell the bad morality to us. They literally package it and give it to us. You know that show, The Voice, right?
All right.
The Voice and American Got Talent, British Got Talent, and all these ones. If you do a bit of search, especially The Voice, I'm not sure about the talents ones. The Voice itself was designed by the Jews. And they themselves, I mean, you'll find the report online. They said, we designed this to keep the Muslims occupied.
Oh my God.
So they deliberately working on ways and methods to distract me and you. They have, in 2010, they had an annual meeting in Israel of how they could defame and work so hard to make people have less connection with the Marja'iyya, because they understand the Marja'iyya is a source of a threat. How can they weaken it? So they're constantly working. So when they make products, we are the first target.
All right.
They sometimes is designed for us and specifically for us. And we have this thing that, oh, I want to be modernized. I want to be, you know, I want to live in the modern
center
age.
Center of attraction.
Yeah, I don't want to live in the dark ages. I don't want to live in a cave. So I need to cope with the trend
changing
that's
world.
Happening, changing world. So we start to adopt without even asking, without even trying to see what the hell is going on. So
yeah.
this is a problem that we're facing as parents. We say, well, you can't do that, right? You have to be at least aware of what's happening to
what
you.
What content is being fed
yeah.
to you.
So when you look at all these speakers, when you look at all this content that's being given to our children, sometimes we as parents, you know, find it very hard to, I mean, a lot of parents, like, they bring their kids to me. They're like, okay, he's got a question. I don't know how to answer it.
All right.
I mean, that's a disaster when your child asks you a question. I mean, alhamdulillah, at least they say, okay, I don't know how to answer it. I will take it to someone who will. So as parents, we need to understand how we can defend our faith ourselves, how we can refute an argument, how we can stand up to all these people that are coming these days with all the ideas. And then I can teach my children. So to go back to your question, I need to give my children the proper education from
yeah.
a young age. I need to slowly put the information in their heads and grow with it.
Thank you so much, brother, for being with us. Thank you so much,
my
dear
pleasure.
Listeners, for listening to the program. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us. Please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our sessions again on our official website, that's parstoday.com. Go to Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله، الله يا الله والحمد لله، الله ولا إله إلا الله، الله يا الله والله أكبر.
O Prophet, Allah is sufficient for you and for such the believers that follow you. What an honorable address for the pious believers. What an address of accountability for the pious believers. Honorable, because although Allah, the Blessed and Exalted, suffices and no person has any power vis-a-vis the exalted truth, and all are insignificant, nevertheless, the sublime and almighty Allah has favored the pious believers with the honor of also mentioning them beside His own blessed name in the verse, "For you, O Prophet, God and those who have followed, and the pious believers who have obeyed your call are sufficient."
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Quran. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has mentioned that there is no school above the Quran. In this small statement, he has said a lot of things. There are many, many things that are hidden in it. And that is that the only school, the only thought, the only ideology that we need to follow is the Quran, which is the book of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah has sent the Quran and He sent it for the guidance of the mankind. He sent it for the mankind, not only for the believers, not only for the Muslims, but the mankind. And therefore he says that it is a clear statement for the mankind. هذا بيان للناس. The word ناس has been used. The mankind. Therefore, Allah didn't say that this is a book for Muslims. He said this is a clear statement for the mankind, and there is a guidance in it, and there is an admonition in it. So whoever wants the guidance, whoever wants the admonition, whoever wants the advice, he must look at the Quran. And Quran is something which is a clear statement. It is not confusing. It does not have any hard thing in it. It is a clear statement. It has clear evidences in it. The history that we see, which has been narrated in the Quran, which has been said in the Quran, it is all clearly said. The examples are very clear. Therefore, whoever wants the guidance, whoever wants the advice, he must follow the teachings of the Quran. And the best school in the world is the school of Quran. The best ideology is the ideology of the Quran. Therefore, there is no school above the Quran. Why? Because the other schools are made of humans. Even when we look at the Christianity or Judaism, this is not the actual religion which was brought by the Jesus Christ or the Prophet Moses and Prophet Abraham, whereas these are the deviations. And the followers of these prophets, they entered their own ideas or their own explanations and their thoughts into the religion. Whereas Quran is not being changed. This is one of the miracles that for the past 1,400 years, since the Quran is revealed upon the Prophet, since he made his companions writing the verses of the Quran, since that time till now, there is no change in the Quran. And therefore, it is necessary to follow such a school which is above all and which is directly attached to the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, insha'Allah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
illallah. Economic divide.
When it comes to the new world order, that obviously will include a new financial order. But for that to happen, it's a tall order. But it is in motion. Two countries that are leading the way in establishing the mechanics of this, they are Russia and Iran. Hi, I'm Kavit Halfway, and this is Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the sanctioned ones. Iran and Russia are setting the new rules. They're doing that because they want to break the West's global financial grip. Will that happen, and how are they going about it? Also coming up in this program, we will take a look at the new settlement currency. It's pegged to the national currencies. And as a result, that will lead to the dollar collapse and undermine U.S. military and political power. Then we will take a look at the new what's called RIC. That's right. RIC to stand for Russia, Iran, and China. They're integrating their financial systems. And one of the things that's important is Iran, which is important to China in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
The war in Ukraine and the ensuing crisis that emerged between Russia and the West has shifted the geopolitics and strategic alliances in Europe, West Asia, and Eurasia. Following the crisis, Russia was hit with a series of unprecedented sanctions that were aimed at making the country's economy collapse. But Russia appears to have survived the crisis. Moscow has now decided to shift its strategic partnership toward the East and to develop closer ties with countries like Iran and China. Iran has welcomed the move since it has been under Western unilateral sanctions for years. But over the years, Iran has managed to thwart Western economic pressures and revive its economy. The two countries, with China on their side, are now determined to further boost their ties in an effort to create a partnership that are immune to Western interference. Even before the war began in Ukraine, Iran and Russia were mulling to significantly boost their trade ties. When President Raisi visited Russia in January of this year, the two sides discussed a draft agreement on strategic cooperation for the next 20 years. Things now appear to fast-track between Russia and Iran, since both Moscow and Tehran are under Western sanctions. Barter arrangements are gaining ground. Tehran is offering spare parts and gas turbines to Moscow's power plants in exchange for much-needed zinc, aluminum, lead, and steel for its metal and mining industries. And more barter on a wide range of commodities is ahead, as discussed during a recent visit to Tehran by the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak.
Social media posts on this topic were varied, even though some out there are aware that there is a major transformation that's taking place, which will push the U.S. and Western countries down the global order a notch or two. The majority remain in the dark, which is why we are here. This is our first post. Russia now faces a greater number of U.S. sanctions than every other nation combined. The world's most sanctioned countries include two of India's neighbors, Myanmar and Iran. Now missing from the list are two other neighbors, each with a record of renegade actions, Pakistan and China. Next up, sanctions are a new form of warfare, causing the same amount of mass suffering and death. This is according to Abby Martin from the Empire Files. She says the goal is to decimate entire economies for refusing to bow down to the will of the empire. Next up, while the U.S. is busily impoverishing the EU and imposing sanctions that hurt their economy, Russia and China are opening the first automobile bridge across the Amur River between the two countries to start cargo traffic that will help boost trade turnover to $200 billion. Here's a viewer comment that says Janet Yellen is saying the restrictions on Russia are hurting U.S. homes, yet sanctions are effective. How can any sane individual support such nonsense? And our final post, soon President Xi will meet with Saudi Arabia King Salman. Could this be a new Quincy Pact? Drop the petrodollar and start working on a new financial system. Saudi Arabia has been supporting Russia on Ukraine and has very close ties with China. And it's not even taking Biden's calls. All right, those were some of the online posts there. Let me introduce our first guest for this segment of the Q&A, Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh joins us. He's a political analyst from Tehran. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome to Economic Divide. The Russia-Iran front has been fast evolving, but it really took a step up in its speed. In January of this year, the Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi went to Moscow, and they both signed on to a strategic cooperation deal of 20 years in duration, building on their good cooperation. And this obviously includes the expansion of economic ties. When it comes to the way that this now works out in the Ukraine war, will things fast track now that Russia is, like Iran, heavily sanctioned?
Iran has a lot of experience in let's say, circumventing or nullifying the sanctions for the last four decades. And now that the Russians are facing sanctions and a lot of economic problems, after the incidents and developments in Ukraine. So there are a lot of things that Tehran can share with Moscow. The point is that the global area, the global era, is moving toward more cooperation in regional levels. So the old world order is actually disappearing right now, and the new world order is forcing countries to establish regional cooperation with each other.
All right. Denis Rogatsiak joins us now. Let's see what he thinks. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano, who joins us from Mexico. Denis, welcome to Economic Divide. The first Eurasia Economic Forum actually was just held, and it's regarded as a milestone because it is said that it actually set up the parameters of the geo-economic integration, as it has been called, of the Eurasia heartland. Now, you have Sergei Glazyev, Russia's minister in charge of integration and macroeconomics at that union, that said that there's a drive to design an alternative monetary financial system. Tell us how that works out and how that would undermine the U.S. dollar and, in turn, the U.S. itself, military and politically.
I believe what we're witnessing right now is kind of the phasing out of the U.S. dollar as the financial hegemon across the world. And I believe this is a process that has been taking place for a good part of the last 20 years. Not just with the rise of China, you know, the return of Russia, the drive for greater sovereignty, economic sovereignty across Latin America, say the expansion of the cooperation between the African continent and China, but also, of course, the recent events in Ukraine are actually also pushing towards the rise of Russia and China and Iran as kind of the financial and economic alternative to the United States, as we've seen now with Russia, with its vast economic power, particularly in the energy sector, has effectively been able to set the rules for energy prices with regards to the use of their national currency for purchases. So basically, forcing their partners in Europe and across the world to adopt ruble as the main means of exchange.
It is time now for our Info News section of the program, where we take a look at economic news from around the world. Our first stop, the Bilderberg Group. That's right, you haven't heard that name in a while. Well, it has reconvened in person after a two-year pandemic gap. It's a high-level council of war, the way it was described. It was headlined by Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General. Also within this, I guess, secret or not so secret meeting, a new financial system was also revealed. Of course, that is something that the Bilderberg Group is very much known for, the secrecy and how it executes it for a world order that they deem to be a world order. Next up, U.S. inflation hit a 40-year high of 8.6% as food, gas, and shelter costs have risen in that country, and that is increasing. And the inflation rate, well, it has sent the stock markets into a tailspin. For example, the S&P 500 has fallen over 2%, and NASDAQ was down over 3.5% as of the recording of this program. Next up, the Americas Summit. The Summit of the Americas was meant to counter China's influence. Instead, it showed how weak the U.S. was. The event was soured by snubs, diplomatic tensions on the rise in that summit, because even before it started, Mexico boycotted it, and others sent low-level delegates. And this is called one of the biggest flops of the Biden presidency and of this particular summit, the Summit of the Americas, hosted by the U.S. Our final pick, stagflation. The World Bank says most countries are headed for a recession, warning of a possible return to what's called the 1970s stagflation, which happened back then. Several years of above-average inflation and below-average growth are now likely because of it. So that is another challenge for not only the world economy, but countries in particular like the U.S. Well, those were the stories that we picked for this section called the Info News section. We would love to hear from you.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
It's time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to sanctions, Iran was one of the countries sanctioned most by the U.S. That's a well-known fact. Although Russia at this point has taken the lead, both can now actually move forward and take the lead together in the way to basically evade sanctions, which is in line with what is unfolding, and that's the new financial order. Now, Sergei Glazyev, you may not have heard of him. He's a leading Russian economist, and he has said that a complete overhaul of the Western-dominated global monetary and financial system is under works, and the world's rising powers are buying into it. Now, this is, of course, countries, when he refers to that, Russia and then Iran, especially when it comes to the whole notion of sanction evasion. Now, the new monetary system, we've talked about that in previous programs. It is still unfolding, and its consequences are pretty dramatic. The Eurasia Economic Union and the China Association together, cooperation between the two, will catapult changes to continue this new financial order. This will ultimately entail the collapse of the dollar system and the final undermining, as a result of that, of the U.S. military and political power. But what was the start of all of this? That's probably a question that you may ask. Well, this was thrown into high gear when U.S., EU, and the U.K. froze the Russian dollar's reserves, that is, in Western central banks. $630 billion is what we had in terms of the foreign exchange reserves that Russia had. And that was a big mistake. This undermined the status of the dollar as a result, not to mention the euro and the pound as global reserve currencies. This was the death wish for the dollar, as some have said, and the euro, as it undermined, as I just mentioned, the status of the dollar, the euro, and the pound. So that move by the U.S. and its allies, in Europe in particular, undermined the status of the dollar through the confiscation of Russia's currencies in central banks. Okay? Now, the use of national currencies and clearing mechanisms backed by bilateral currency swaps is the first phase of this new financial system. Okay? There's three phases. The next phase, the new pricing mechanisms that do not reference the dollar. This is the second phase of the new financial system that is occurring as we speak. And then finally, third phase, that is comprised of the creation of a new digital payment currency, weight of each currency, and to make that shorter, is proportional to the GDP of each country. That is important. So there you have the new financial system in just a short form in terms of the explanation. However, let me bring back our guest to break this down further for us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh is a political analyst from Tehran who rejoins us. Hamid Reza Ghulamzadeh, welcome back. We're looking at the countries that have been sanctioned, like Iran and Russia, and some have analyzed their cooperation as to be one that is setting new rules in this new financial global order. At this point, that is kind of paving the way for China when it comes to the U.S. sanctions in terms of how it is going to wean off the U.S. dollar as one of the things that it's going to do. We're also looking at Latin American countries who are moving away from the U.S. dollar. Can you please then tell us how all of this undermines the U.S. financial system in particular and the Western global stranglehold?
You know, there is a great opportunity right now for the sanctioned countries to work with each other. We would call it the sanction club, we can say. The club of countries that are sanctioned, put under the sanction of the Americans. And this is actually the fault of the Americans, that they overused actually their system of weaponization of dollar by imposing sanctions on countries across the world, on Iran, on Venezuela, on Cuba, on Russia, on Syria, on Lebanon, and many countries. They are imposing actually sanctions on. And this has created a club of countries that can work with each other without fear of further sanctions, because Iran is has been sanctioned to the most, and even Trump administration admitted that they don't have any further sanctions to impose on Iran, and there is no further fear of any more sanctions.
All right, let's bring in Denis Rogatyuk. He rejoins us. He's an international editor at El Ciudadano. Denis Rogatyuk, welcome back. When you take a look at countries like Russia and Iran, they're the ones that have been leading the pack, so to speak, of Western sanctions, in particular by the U.S. This is in line with the new financial order that we're looking at, and people have referred to it as the New World Order. Can you tell us how this is going to reshape the way that countries are going to deal with each other away from the U.S. dollar, for
most definitely. We have to remember